Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
One Heap Minute Productions presents Guide for the Film Fanatic, the podcast where we invite a guest to pick one movie from Danny Perry's seminal 1986 film reference book and talk to us about that movie. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host. Our guest today is an Edgar Award-winning and New York Times best-selling crime novelist whose books include Beware the Woman, The Turnout, Give Me Your Hand, You Will Know Me, Bury Me Deep, The Fever, and Dare Me, the latter of which was adapted into a television series for USA on which she was co-showrunner. She was also a staff writer on HBO's The Deuce and wrote the nonfiction study The Street Was Mine, White Masculinity in Hard-Boiled Fiction and Film Noir. Her new novel is called El Dorado Drive, and it is on shelves now. Folks, say hello to the one and only Megan Abbott. Hi, Megan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on the new show. You were one of our favorite guests on A Very Good Year. Let's start by plugging. Tell us about your latest hit book, El Dorado Drive. Which I'm sure I'm saying it right. I'm very conscious of it now.
You got it. Yeah, it's really about a bunch of, you know, middle-aged women who sort of lost their money in the recession and take up a money-making operation that my pitch to it was Goodfellas in a Country Club. So short version.
That is like high quality, the player style elevator pitch. Nice job. One of the things that we love so much about you, and one of the reasons we always want to have you on our shows, is that you're a novelist, acclaimed bestselling, but you're such a cinephile, and your books are always so informed by the movies that you love. Were there any particular ones, aside from the one you just mentioned, that sort of fed into the writing process of El Dorado Drive?
Yeah, I suppose because it's set in a suburb of Detroit, really the same one I grew up in, Grosse Pointe, I did look at a lot of suburban country club kind of movies like The Swimmer and Virgin Suicides, which is actually set in the same town I'm from. Grosse Pointe. So it's its only claim, well, Grosse Pointe Blank, though they didn't shoot that there, but Virgin Suicides they did. So that kind of, it's a kind of a place that's trapped in time, you know, like almost like Blue Velvet's Lumberton, you know, it feels trapped in the past. And one of my dad's jokes used to always be that Eisenhower is still president there. So I was looking at a lot of movies like that, that feel very like nothing ever changes. It's big wasp territory. So.
Got it. Understood. And are you still, I mean, I know, from experience, you never stop promoting the book, but have you concluded the book tour, or is that still going on?
By and large, over just a few spare events. Right now I'm working on A24 bought the rights to El Dorado Drive, so I'm writing the pilot for them. So we'll see.
That's huge. Congratulations.
Thank you. You never know where these things will go, but it's been great working with them. Obviously, I love their movies so much, so, and their shows. So fingers crossed.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, what is the process of adaptation like for you? How do you go about sort of, especially when you're turning it into a series as opposed to just a film, how do you go about sort of unlocking the difference between those mediums and figuring out how to make one work in the other?
Yeah, obviously, it seems obvious, but it isn't until you start to do it. But you, of course, have to think so much more visually, and books are so interior. They're so intimate. You hear the characters' thoughts. And so you have to find a way visually to do that. And when you're in production on a show, you know, the cinematographer and the actors, they can all make that come alive. But when you're writing a pilot, you have to make it come alive even on the page. So you have to think of visual ways to convey emotional states and all of that. And then, of course, sort of embrace everything I love about movies, which is how, I mean, the book is a series of parties. So I did also look at the greatest party scenes or drunk scenes from movies. You know, Mean Streets is one of my favorite ones. Drunk Harvey Keitel when he's moving.
Yes. So the Rubber Biscuit song. Yes.
Yes. So it's just a matter of like pivoting to that. And then Killing All Your Darlings, of course,
because
you page everything. So.
That's great. Well, congratulations on the success of the book, and fingers crossed that that goes through. Can't wait to see that. What film from Guide for the Film Fanatic did you select to discuss with us today?
I chose one of my favorite movies of all time, A Body Double.
And here is a trailer. Barbara Crampton is in the trailer. Love that for all of us. I did a double take. This was the first time I'd seen the movie since knowing who she was, where I was like, is that? And I had to pause and go look her up. And sure enough, there's Barbara Crampton.
This is really nice.
No thanks necessary. One struggling actor helping out another.
I'm always glad when women want to talk about Brian De Palma Peeper movies. I'm always glad because there's always some, there's always some perspective I hadn't thought of. I get so pearl clutchy with his movies. It's like, I am not like that. I mean, I like all kinds of weird shit, but like for some reason his movies, you're watching this lady changing her drawers and oh my goodness, I just get like, whew.
They're very visceral.
His movies make me blush. Like, I am nearly 50. It is the craziest thing to say out loud, but...
Yes. I think his goal is to make us all feel like perverts, and I think he's...
Yeah. I gotta say, hats off to the trailer cutting team at Columbia Pictures for realizing to basically just build the second half of the trailer around the relaxed sequence. Like, that's how you sell a movie, is with this song and those images, and then people dying. That's like 100%. I'm in. When do I go see this movie?
To people now how strange that was that there would be a music video dropped in the middle of the movie. It was such early days of music videos. So.
Yes. It's one of my favorite things about the movie.
I mean, this is described as like, you know, very Hitchcockian and like very, very De Palma, but it's more absurd in places than I think of his movies, and especially the whole thing at the end. I don't think of that as a thing that he does at all. Like, at all. And it does it well. I mean, obviously, you know, it's by the time you get to that point in the film, I'm with him. But I don't think of that as a De Palma thing.
No, I do think it's, I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen it with an audience. And that is a unique experience, especially if they've seen it, because it does go so, it really becomes so Baroque and over the top. And I find it's like hard to be offended by things that could seem objectively offensive because it's so extreme, but he really did have an axe to grind. I'm sure we'll talk about when he made it. And he really was determined to really go for broke with this one.
Yes, indeed. That's a perfect segue. Body Double is director Brian De Palma's 1984 Hitchcockian thriller, co-written with Robert J. Avrich, most of whose other credits are in TV movies, though he did pen another Melanie Griffith movie, A Stranger Among Us, which was the first major motion picture credit for one James Gandolfini. This was De Palma's follow-up to Scarface, which was much more of a kind of gun-for-hire project. It had originated with Sidney Lumet planning to direct, and with De Palma planning to direct Prince of the City, and then through the oddities of Hollywood dealing, they ended up swapping movies. But anyway, that was a gun-for-hire project, so he wanted to follow it up with something that was very much recognizably in his style, and Body Double is certainly that. The story goes that he was so frustrated by the endless back and forth battle with the MPAA over Scarface that he basically said, fuck it, my next movie is just going to be an X-rated movie. One of those occasional, you know, provocations by a real filmmaker to bridge the gulf between mainstream and adult entertainment. So he went buck wild with the sex and violence in this one, only to discover that Columbia did in fact expect him to deliver a movie that could play in multiplexes and be advertised on television and print, although there was some difficulty in that realm. Anyway, Mike, what does Mr. Danny Perry say about Body Double in Guide for the Film Fanatic?
He said, this is a long-ass paragraph, son. Take a drink of water. Then he says, disappointing suspense thriller by Brian De Palma that he borrows from Hitchcock's Vertigo, Rear Window, and Psycho is not as annoying as his repeating himself. He makes so sure his scenes have parallels in Hitchcock that his own storyline gets muddled. Craig Wasson plays a third-rank actor who has acute claustrophobia, making him the perfect patsy in Greg Henry's Murder Plans.
Wow, spoiler alert, Danny Perry, jeez.
Henry offers Wasson a place to stay and supposedly leaves town. Wasson becomes obsessed with spying through his telescope at a nearby apartment where a beautiful woman does an exotic nude dance by the window. He doesn't realize that the woman who lives there, Deborah Shelton, is not the woman Melanie Griffith doing the dance.
Every spoiler you could get.
He really is. This movie was like 6 months old when he wrote this book. What the heck, Mr. P?
He worries that the woman he's watching is in danger because he has spotted someone else, an Indian, spying on her. One night, he looks through his telescope and witnesses Shelton being attacked. He races to the rescue, too late, and, of course, it looks like he is the murderer. De Palma's camera is fluid and his direction is so imaginative. De Palma's camera is fluid and his direction is so imaginative at times that you almost gasp. But Wasson's much duller here than in other films. The storyline's so predictable that the intricacy of De Palma's direction seems wasted. And when De Palma starts showing off with one of his long non-dialogue passages when Wasson follows Shelton, the picture becomes boring. The nature of Shelton's murder, with a drill that the killer clutches between his legs, was just De Palma doing a little feminist baiting in hopes of making his picture controversial enough to be a big moneymaker. His ploy didn't work. As a platinum blonde porno star, Melanie Griffith is the best reason to see this picture. English rock group Frankie Goes to Hollywood made their appearance here before they played. Wow. That's the first one I have to say that I'm just sort of like, nah. It's just not even, there's the only things he has to say in there that I kind of relate to are super obvious. Which is sort of like my review of his review is sort of like his review of this movie, unfortunately.
Well, Megan, take us back. When did you first see Body Double? How did this movie make its way into your life?
Yeah, it was a long time ago. I really fell for De Palma in my 20s, I would say. So it was too young when it came out, but I definitely saw it on VHS. I really fell in love with the first, like, Carrie and Dress to Kill. And then, you know, that led me here. And I think I had read about it first through, because I was a kid, used to read all those books of Pauline Kael reviews. And Pauline Kael famously was a De Palma defender, except her review of this movie, which she basically makes the same. I mean, the claim that he's just ripping off Hitchcock is one that he would fight through the whole first half of his career. But I think what she misunderstands and what Danny misunderstands is that he's playing with those tropes. He's, you know, doing and undoing them. This is a postmodern movie. And I think that for reviewers, I think that's why the movie's become so renowned in the years since. We just have a deeper understanding of what he was trying to do with movie tradition, with ideas of gender, with ideas of sexuality, being playful with, you know, I mean, if anything, it's a movie about toxic masculinity. It's not about, you know, any of the, which of course Hitchcock's movies are in large part about, but I think De Palma knows that they are. And I don't know if was. I wrote one of my master's essays in grad school on this movie. And
oh, my goodness.
And it was the first time that had ever happened in the NYU English department. it was deconstruction. I took a deconstruction approach to it because I think that's what he's doing. Mm-hmm. I taught the movie before. So this has been a movie that I've defended through my whole life to angry feminists, of which I am one, but the people who don't get it. just to people that think that Craig Wasson is just a bad actor rather than that's the part he's playing. That's the whole idea that he's supposed to play this buffoon who's been emasculated and helpless. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the whole, we'll talk about the whole second half of the movie undoes the first half. It's such a clever conceit. So it's been something I've loved, you know, for decades now.
Well, I mean, what really jumped out at me on this viewing, and I think I may had only seen it once before, many, many years ago. So a lot of it was one of those weird instances, and I know you've probably encountered this too, where sometimes you see a movie, you like a movie, but then if you go a long time without seeing it, you kind of like re-edit it in your brain, placing more emphasis on your favorite stuff in it. And I felt like the Melanie Griffith stuff was like 2/3 of this movie minimum, if not 3/4. And then it's like an hour in and I'm like, where the fuck is Melanie Griffith? Like, it's just, I really had forgotten a lot of the setup, the first half of it, which is fascinating and effective in its own way. But what was really striking to me on this viewing, as someone who has spent much more time thinking about watching De Palma, was, and Perry alluded to this in a negative way, but I think it's what makes it sort of fascinating. It is self-referential.
Yes.
In a way that not much of his other work is. Like, in terms of specific sequences that are recalling, riffing on, and perhaps subverting previous sequences in his films. The fact that it opens just like Blowout, with a fake out, with a low budget horror film within the film, I don't think is accidental. I don't think is lazy. And the fact that Dennis Franz is there when it's happening is also noteworthy. The whole following her sequence is so directly, reanimating Dress to Kill. But then especially at the end, the way that the ending plays into all of the sort of breathless buzz that was surrounding the nude scene in Dress to Kill, the nude shower scene in Dress to Kill, where Angie Dickinson uses a body double, like that's the title of the thing. I don't think I knew his stuff as well the first time I saw it. So I really was struck by how much he's shouting out his own stuff. And I would love to hear your thoughts on that from the deconstructionist standpoint that you were just talking about.
Yes, no, that was exactly, if I could remember my long ago paper, was exactly what it was about. It's, you have these three levels of meta, right, that he's doing with. Because of course that famous scene in Dress to Kill, where she's at the museum and this long sequence of this man, handsome man, following her, and you know, is sort of a reversal of Vertigo. You know, right. This is the whole premise that he, in this movie, that he sees a murder through the window is something that happens in Sisters, which happens in Rear Window. So he's
right,
influence upon influence. It's a really fascinating move from modernism to postmodernism, where it's become a play with symbols. We've moved so far from the real that this is a movie about movies. That's why we start with this fake backdrop, and we have rear screen projection, you know, that he's constantly emphasizing the artifice of everything.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even notice it till this time, but the vampire garb that Craig Wasson wears at the beginning in costume, you know, the sort of peroxide and the leather, is what Melanie Griffith is wearing in the second half, in the scene.
Right.
She, even within the movie, it's sort of doing another riff on what he's already done. So it's such glorious play to me. It makes it such a joyous experience watching it. And of course, even the drill is a little bit of a wink to Scarface, of course, with that's a different weapon, but it's very
right.
Was the right. Scene that got him the X, right? That initially that was changed.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, well, that was the other thing that really jumped out at me this time too, was he's referencing himself, he's referencing Hitchcock, but he's also doing, I was not well versed in giallo when I saw this movie for the first time, but the fact that he has that Pino Donaggio score, which is extremely giallo influenced, that he's got a black gloved killer, which is sort of the most recognizable aesthetic of giallo, and even down to this strange decision that he made to dub Deborah Shelton's voice.
Yes.
You hired Helen Shaver to do Deborah Shelton's voice because he decided he didn't like her voice in post. Like, it's strange, but those sorts of post-production dubbing decisions happen all the time in giallo. So there's all of that sort of American giallo stuff happening.
Absolutely. I know he's denied that he ever watched Jello, but I don't believe him.
I don't either.
You've probably seen the documentary about him. He's like a little bit of an irascible guy, and he's never good
yes.
at doing it. But you're right. I hadn't even thought of the dubbing. And of course, the dubbing also is very effective because she's an unreal person. She's not a real
right.
person. So that disconnect works even more.
Yeah. And then that there were also a couple of sort of explicit shout outs to slasher movies. Like, by 84, we're sort of on the downslope of the slasher trend. This is the year that Friday the 13th, the quote unquote final chapter, comes out, etc. But there's a phone cord choking, which is straight out of Halloween. And then the drill as the murder weapon is, first of all, in Driller Killer, but specifically, like, the framing of it, deploying it as a phallic symbol, is straight out of Slumber Party Massacre.
Yes.
Like, this is, it's such a it's a text that is so rich with references, and the fact that it is set in the world of actors and set in this world of artifice and has, like you say, all of these sort of film references is really clever. And I think maybe even, whether he was doing it consciously or not, a really interesting way to sort of face the ongoing Hitchcock swiping accusations kind of straight on, to be like, no, look, I'm going to steal from everybody in this movie, including myself.
Yes, exactly. And I think the thing he does with Hitchcock is so great, because he brings forward what's repressed in Hitchcock, because he has Craig Wasson actually, like, sniff her panties in this, which is like, not, I mean, he's really like, we know that Jimmy Stewart in Vertigo is a pervert, but we don't actually see
right.
him do anything like that. But, you know, there's no, I mean, they're practically, he and Greg Henry looking across, they're practically like slathering, they're like cartoon characters or something.
Ooga, ooga, blah, 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 blah. Yeah.
Exactly. He's not going to glamorize them. So he's sort of, he's turning it into, I mean, there is a real campness to this movie, I think, that takes it away, you know. And then, you know, when I've seen it with audiences, they lose their mind with laughter in the big kiss scene, which is also
yes.
a nod to Hitchcock. But
totally.
I don't think they understand that it's supposed to be over the top, that's, you know, because it's a romantic fantasy, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Like, Hitchcock had to shoot it the way that De Palma apes there, you know, with the rear projection and all of that, because, like, the technology didn't exist to circle a couple in that way and at that speed. It certainly did by the time De Palma's making Body Double. So he's choosing to make it artificial. He's choosing to reference that kind of Hitchcockian artificiality. And I think it's kind of a genius choice. And the music is so cheesy, and they're groping so blatantly, and you just go with it. You know, you're like, okay, well, sure. All right.
Yes, it goes on forever, which is so great. And that you reminded me, thinking of all the self-references, because they're in the elevator right before that, which is another Dressed to Kill reference. And
yep.
she's dressed in the all white suit, like much like Angie Dickinson is in her scene. So I think it's just such a rich text with so much play. And as you say, he's choosing these methods he doesn't even need to use, a lot like rear screen projection, like the way he shoots that, he puts everything in quotes in the movie.
Right.
I think that's what makes it so great. And what, you know, and if you had any doubt about it, the second half, which is actually less than half, as you point out, it's like you just, Melanie Griffith is so great. You wish that she had come in sooner because she's such a delight, but she really pulls the pin out of any notions of this like femme fatale, you know, like she's so grounded and real and such an active person. And she's so, she does not see the spell, the sexuality as this kind of spell, this thing that you draw love for her. She's very practical and it's so incredible.
I think even the lead character, I mean, the actor too, but the character more than the actor is also sort of a throwback, even like a comment on a comment where initially I think that guy was sort of milquetoast or plain in a way because he was supposed to be like the audience surrogate or whatever. And so he's kind of like a normal guy being thrown into like a wacky situation. But then eventually, and I mean, by the time of, let's say, Rear Window, that guy is still being that guy. But it turns out he's actually the one who's maybe the main weirdo or the main one to be worried about or whatever. And you realize that all of the other stuff is sort of a cover for that. And I mean, here we are, you know, this is... he's sort of doing that thing once again with this guy who's not particularly interesting on his own, not particularly successful. The first thing we find out about him is that his wife is not interested, at least in only sleeping with him anymore, right? I mean, sort of like, so, but anyway, and then you turn out he's fucking nuts, da-da-da. And just that character by itself felt, the Rear Window comparisons are so sort of obvious that it makes you think a little bit more about why anyone would do that, let alone repeat it.
That's right. And instead of a fear of heights, he's had claustrophobia, which is actually the first humiliation, I guess. You know,
right.
His woman being caught in bed is the second one. He's having the worst day ever, and he's such a sad sack about it. And she can't even be bothered to get off the guy she's having sex with. I mean, she really lays it on thick.
Well, and that great moment where he confesses that it maybe even isn't so much the adultery, but that she was clearly enjoying it so much more than she does with him. It's like, wow.
She's glowing.
Glowing.
Well, have you ever heard the idea that claustrophobia is essentially a form? I don't know if it's Freudian specifically, but it's definitely drawn out of the idea that claustrophobia is a sexual repression, a fear of like intimacy in a way that like bodies are, because you see like he gets bugged out in the coffin, but then the next time he gets bugged out is when he's fine in the space until all those extra bodies come in. And if you really want to get fucking into it, then there's the idea that this sort of male claustrophobia is actually the fear that you might like lose your joint forever when it goes into the cave, right? That kind of like, and if that is I would call that speculative at best, but I think De Palma probably knows about it.
I'm sure he does, because it's also, you know, another version of it with same idea. The fear of femininity, a different version of fear of femininity is that it's the womb, right? And he can't.
Right.
He can't become a man. He can't even get out of the womb. And interestingly, De Palma, that's the childhood story he tells is something that happened to him. He's playing with his brothers and he got trapped in a refrigerator. So I love that he picked his own story to sort of as this foolish saps. trauma, which is kind of endearing. It's sort of, I always love that in Dress to Kill, the Keith Gordon character is definitely based on De Palma, who was a big tech nerd as a kid.
Right.
and whose father, was, he didn't have a great dad. His dad was not great to his mom. So I think he is in these movies. They're not just about other movies, but the reason we love the movies we love are because they speak to our deepest anxieties and desires and fears. And so I kind of love that about him too.
Right. Right. How do we feel about Craig Wasson in this role? And I mostly ask because when I was researching and prepping the show, I found that the Hollywood Reporter had reported that at one point Kurt Russell was in talks for this role. And I don't know how cool. I feel about
that. He wouldn't have been able to do that like sort of like weird sort of like guy in the corner, like watching a hot chick across the street. He just doesn't have that sort of like.
Russell has too much swagger to have pulled it off.
Yeah, he's got too much BDE, you know.
Great to think. I mean, this, if you think of like Disney era Kurt Russell, even Disney, because he hadn't done a lot of his big action movies. Yeah, but still I can. I think Craig Wasson, I mean, I'll admit the first few times I watched it, I was like, who is this guy?
why is Bill Maher in this erotic thriller? Right.
He is just so, no one could be this, aw, shucks, but I now believe that it's a brilliant performance because I think that's who he's playing, in the first half. He has this a lot. He's been through a lot in the second half, let's just say, and he smartens up. But I think it so works because he has to feel like such a schmuck, such a sap, because that's what Greg Henry obviously marks him from the start.
Totally.
And it's totally. So elegantly done in the script how he, I mean, there are some plot holes in the movie, I won't deny, as a crime author, but it's pretty tight. And when you watch it again, you do see how quickly he's clocked him. Is that, this is the loser. This is the loser that I'm going to get.
Yeah.
To do this for me. Yeah.
I will say that was one of the pleasures of rewatching it after so long was I had forgotten the intricacies of the plot. So I got to let it work itself out again. And it is, I apologize to anyone who's listening to this before they've seen it and now knows all of the turns from Mr. P's capsule, but it is like, they are well spaced and the reveals are really juicy. And I would imagine, Megan, that is really a huge part of constructing a mystery, is knowing when to put those turns in and to make them feel revealed without feeling withheld. Am I making any sense at all?
No, that's exactly it. Because you want to play fair. You can't have, there's at the bar when Greg's like, well, maybe you can stay at this place. He says, let me make a call first. And of course, you later know why he needed to make a call to set something up. But like, that's the kind of stuff. If you don't show that, you're cheating. You're not giving the viewer all the information they need. So that is it. Don't want to do it in a way that feels obvious, that the viewer will immediately get what's going on. So, and I think Greg Henry is so wonderful in this movie, and he's so good at like riding that line too, where he's a real, he's a real hustler, but he's also playing that kind of guy. Like, look at this great house I've just stumbled into. And, he's just very good at it. But it is, I think it's pretty well done. And it just pays off when all the pieces come together, when he, you realize what he's been doing, and you have this you always want to have this sort of cascade where the viewer or the reader like puts all of it together at once.
And that's a cool sequence when they sort of lay it out and we see the little flashbacks and so forth. That kind of thing can be heavy-handed or overdone, and I think he does it just right. Megan, we would be remiss, especially without such a brilliant woman on the show, to ignore the elephant in the room, the primary criticism of this film at the time and subsequently perhaps, is that it reeks of misogyny, that it's cruel and violent towards women, that the only important women characters are, the topless cheating girlfriend, the naked girl in the window, and the porn star. What are your thoughts, defenses, grantings, how do you respond to those pretty frequent criticisms of this picture in particular, but in the sort of De Palma oeuvre overall.
Yeah. I mean, I think De Palma always does himself no favors when he's interviewed about this stuff because I just want him to stop talking because he says, well, isn't it much scarier when women are threatened than with men? And like, oh, yeah, but I think you're missing the point. But I just don't see it. I mean, you have an amazingly active woman in this movie that basically steals the movie.
Right.
And you know, in that era, I mean, now we really we have a very, you know, pro-sex work stance, I think, about that. But in the 80s, of course, the fact that she was a sex worker made it less feminine. Like, you can't have, you know, that doesn't count. Or if she's naked, it doesn't count. So I think it's easier to make that charge now. But I don't see how anyone could see that there's, to me, as opposed to some slashers, and I love slashers, but some of them you feel a delectation in the murder of the woman. I don't feel that at all here. I mean, you know, I feel like it's a genuinely harrowing scene, but it's also in that, you know, you really are frightened. There's a lot going on. There's a dog. There's like two. And it's not dwelling on her mutilation. In fact, you never see the drill actually penetrate. You just see the outcome of it, as opposed to what most slashers in that era would do. So I don't get it. I think it's a kind of narrow view to me of gender and how it works. I think one of the things, I mean, Just to Kill has other issues, but Just to Kill, I think, and Carrie and Sisters are all, he's really interested in gender as a kind of performance. And I think it's a mistake to think about this in really strict essentialist terms about how he views women or how he views men. I mean, the men in this movie are the liars and the idiots. I mean, is that a positive view of men?
Right.
No, you know, I think so Paul has a pretty absurdist view of all human behavior. I think if anything, women get a better pass. I mean, Nancy Allen in Best to Kill is the hero of that movie.
Right.
I get that, you know, if someone doesn't like violent movies, this is probably not going to be the movie for them. But I think that may be the thing that, you know, that I think it's a cheap shot, in other words. And I think it doesn't appreciate what he's really trying to do. That would be my argument.
Well, you make the point about, like, you know, none of the men in this movie are particularly good. I'd also just like to point out that in this movie, there are two actors. One of them is a psychopath and the other one is a total fucking loser. So maybe that's a little bit of commentary, too.
I will say, we mentioned it in the trailer because it's used so well in the trailer, but the relax sequence is such a kick, is so much fun, is so, it's wild when you can pull off as a filmmaker doing something that's completely unexpected but also makes total sense stylistically and kind of narratively. Like, the fact that it is sort of built in that, like, he goes to audition for the thing and then you think you're going to see him go through some sort of process, and then to just leap in and show us the video is brilliant filmmaking, but it also makes so much sense in terms of how media infused the picture is, that the thing to really bear in mind is that this is 84. This is when MTV has really sort of, like, taken over the culture, that we have, like, a short but kind of key shot of him watching MTV in bed. I think even outside of the relax sequence, you see the influence of music videos in style and in sensibility. And I don't think it's an accident that the sparks that are being supplied are from the Indian overworking on a satellite dish. But also the fact that, like, you know, his other big release of 1984 was a music video, was the Dancing in the Dark video. So this is clearly, like, someone who is watching music videos, who is, I hesitate to say, but really learning from music videos, or at least taking the license from them to get a little wild in terms of what he can get away with within a narrative feature.
Yes, and speak to your media point. When he has the revelation about how he has been fooled, it's by watching a video. It's watching a
right
one of Melanie Griffith's pornos, and so you're right. It's all over. Screens are all over, and I think it might have been Travis Woods who point this out. Has written a lot about De Palma, but that video is actually a version of the first half of the movie in some strange way, because in this, Craig Watson's playing an even more obvious nerdy, geeky loser guy, right, with the bow tie and the
sweat
vest, and who's sort of being seduced by the beautiful woman, and she weirdly again is sort of in the garb of the vampire he was playing. So it's such a, I've heard a few people talk about this. Some way you can think about the two parts of the movie as like Mulholland Drive, which it sounds crazy.
Oh, wow,
nice.
It's interesting to think about, because one is the Hollywood fantasy, and the other is the Hollywood reality, which of course is the porn business and everyone being a lawyer and a hustler. That kind of blew my mind.
Wow, that's very, very cool. I gotta say, I'm borderline amazed that we made it 40 minutes into an episode about a De Palma movie without mentioning Travis Woods. But I'm glad he made his way into the show. Hi, Travis. How you doing? Okay, let's take a quick break, and then we will talk about the movie's release and reception.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
All right, friends, let's talk about the release and reception of Body Double, which opened in New York City on October 26th, 1984, alongside American Dreamer, First Born, Give My Regards to Broad Street, Paris, Texas, Streetwise, Terror in the Isles, The Times of Harvey Milk, and a little B-movie called The Terminator. Hell of a day at the movies. Which I also think that rundown might explain something we'll get to a little later about its slightly disappointing initial box office. Also playing in New York that weekend, Amadeus, Repo Man, All of Me, The Brother from Another Planet, Stranger Than Paradise, Crimes of Passion, that'd make a pretty good double feature, Teachers, Garbo Talks, The Razor's Edge, and my favorite movie of 1984, Stop Making Sense. Mike, what were the news headlines on that day?
Friday, October 26, 1984, and on the front page of the New York Times is a story of seven men who were charged with trying to kill the Pope.
Whoa.
Yeah, JP2 had been shot in 1981, and there were rumors of a Bulgarian connection in the wind. The new charges were leveled against three Bulgarians and four Turks. And let me tell you, if there was a woman in silky drawers somewhere in this story, it would be perfect for a Brian De Palma film.
I gotta
say, call
it
the Bulgarian connection.
That's true. 81 to 84, though, they're kind of taking their time trying to find the Pope's.
Well, no. This was they busted a new. These guys were back. That's what I'm saying. There was a guy that had been locked up the whole time, but he was sending kites to the out. It's a connection, Jason. Okay. It's a connection.
All right.
Through Bulgaria, and who's paying attention to what's going on over there? You know what I mean? You can get away with anything in the woods of Bulgaria.
Sure.
U.S. Secretary of State George P. Shultz said that the United States should stop being so considerate. That's my word. I'm condensing here, but... And he said we should start using military force against terrorist groups, even if it leads to the deaths of civilians and service people.
Huh.
He said, quote, "We may never have the kind of evidence that can stand up in an American court of law, but we cannot allow ourselves to become the Hamlet of nations, worrying endlessly over whether and how to respond." Unquote. Then he praised the Israelis. And look, as much as I appreciate the Shakespeare reference, I don't know about the policy. Thankfully, he wasn't Secretary of State forever. And since then, we've done exactly what he suggested.
Yes.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, sorry, yuck. And finally, deep in the paper, we get a couple of graphs about a trustee representing John Z. DeLorean's bankrupt automobile company filing a $100 million lawsuit charging DeLorean, his wife, and a dozen of his associates with fraud. This is John Z. DeLorean of the famous Back to the Future car, of course.
Yes.
They also filed a $150 million lawsuit against the accounting firm who had been signing off on his expense reports. Do you guys know the John Z. DeLorean story? Because it's an amazing story. I don't actually give a fuck about this lawsuit. I just want to take any opportunity I can to publicly suggest people look into the John Z. DeLorean cocaine scandal, because it is fantastic.
It is. It is indeed. And I will take this opportunity that I never miss to tell you that in the Mad Magazine parody of Back to the Future, they had a better line for you built a time machine out of a DeLorean than they had in the movie. It's so good. It stuck with me the entire time. In the Mad Magazine parody, Marty says, "You tell me you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?" And Doc Brown says, "I mean, John DeLorean almost did time for this car. I figured it made sense." Long route to get to that.
And that's why we still need magazines, even though we have
movies.
There
you go. There we go.
Jason, what did the critics say about Body Double?
Vincent Canby sounded, I think, a sensible note in the pages of the Times when he wrote, quote, "Body Double, opening today at United Artists Twin and other theaters, again goes too far, which is the reason to see it. It's sexy and explicitly crude, entertaining and sometimes very funny. It's his most blatant variation to date on a Hitchcock film," although he says Vertigo there, which to me it's like it's as much Rear Window as Vertigo. "But it's also a De Palma original, a movie that might have offended Hitchcock's wryly avuncular public personality while appealing to his darker, most private fantasies," end quote. Thank you, Mr. Canby. Variety was similarly sort of appreciative. Quote, "Brian De Palma lets all his obsessions hang out in Body Double. A voyeur's delight and a feminist nightmare, Sex Spencer features an outrageously far-fetched and flimsy plot which merely serves as an excuse for extended sequences of visual virtuosity and some slumming in the netherworlds of perverse crime, low-budget filmmaking, and pornography. It's an exploitable item for middle-range returns in quick playoff." I just love when Variety like uses that weird jargon to like tell you it's going to make money. I mean this. I would like to like, it's too late, I'm sure, but I'd like to us to spearhead the official movement to change the description from erotic thriller to Sex Spencer.
Sex Spencer.
Combination. This is the word they used here, like it was just common parlance of a sex suspense movie. Sex Spencer. I think it's great.
Just rolls off the tongue.
It does. It's a good Sex Spencer. But okay. Here we go. Here come the pants. In her one star review in the New York Daily News, Kathleen Carroll called it, quote, "a flashy but utterly pointless murder mystery. De Palma has devised a dreadfully offensive murder sequence for the movie, in which the victim is naturally a woman, and in which De Palma, displaying the same relish for torture as a fascist bully or a prison guard, takes a perverse pleasure in focusing his camera on a slowly approaching electric power drill, his choice of murder weapons. Body Double does nothing but confirm De Palma's reputation as a hopeless copycat and a confirmed ripoff artist." She concluded, "The movie is so careless and shoddy, one suspects this overrated peeping Tom of a director whipped it off in his sleep," end quote. And Oh, you know I got to do it. Noted dipshit Rex Reed hyperbolically proclaimed, quote, "A mind-boggling amount of money has been flushed down the drain on a heaping ash can of hysteria and stupidity, totally lacking in structure, style, coherence, and talent." Okay, coherence, okay. Talent, you know, you like what you like. I can't understand how a thinking human being could say that the film lacks in either structure or style. But then again, as we know, Rex Reed.
Coherence? Did you go to the bathroom twice? The movie makes sense. I mean, it gets a little weird at the end, but it makes sense.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Rex continues, "It is one of the most disgraceful abuses of money that has ever been trashed upon the screen. It should be reviewed with a machine gun since it seems to have been made with one." What does that even fucking mean? All right. How did it do in terms of box office and awards, Michael?
Well, hopefully it got at least $6 out of Rex Reed because fuck him. let's see. It topped at $8.8 million, so it left theaters in the red on account of its $10 million budget. That said, it presumably recouped and then some once it got to VHS, where its provocative cover made it a pretty popular rental. And Melody Griffith,
that is an iconic video store. Like every video store I ever worked at, that tape moved. Okay, sorry, Mike.
And Melanie Griffith did surprisingly, but not really, considering how great she is in the movie, well in the year-end awards, landing a Golden Globe nomination, a New York Film Critics Circle Award nomination, and a National Society of Film Critics win for Best Supporting Actress. Good on you, Mel.
All right. And now it's time for a segment we call Double It Up, where we each select one movie that we think would make an ideal double feature with today's focal film. Megan, you're our guest, which means you get to go first.
Okay, I will pick Special Effects, the Larry Cohen movie.
Yes!
Yeah, I think it's the same year.
It is! That's an 84 joint. Well done.
It's Zoe Lund and Eric Bogosian plays the director. And there's two hats. I mean, the movie is definitely bifurcated. Similarly, it's very meta movie, very postmodern in every way. I won't say anything more about it because it's full surprise, but it's also, you know, sexy, violent, and upsetting to some people. So this could be the night to, like, never, not a first date double feature, let's just say.
There you go. There you go. Yeah, we are a very pro Eric Bogosian show, and that may have been like his first sort of leading role in a movie, I think.
I was surprised because I thought he was just doing performance. It's very much set, right. It's a very New York set movie with a lot of New York vibes in it. So it wouldn't surprise me if this was his first big part in a movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a great matchup. That's a terrific movie. Mine is a little more obvious, but I'll explain it, why this one in particular. One of the things that's kind of fascinating when you just sort of look down De Palma's filmography sort of and situate his movies next to each other is that he kind of had a move where if he did something that was sort of out of the usual wheelhouse and it didn't go over, he always followed that up with like the most De Palma shit imaginable, like a real, like, I don't want to say he was retreating. It's just like maybe reminding, like, this is what and I think this being an example of that, sort of the fact that he followed up Scarface, which, lest we forget, at the time was a commercial and critical disappointment, with this extremely De Palma originated story that's totally in his typical pocket. In 1990, he made a movie called Bonfire of the Vanities, which was not well received. And his next movie after that was an extremely De Palma movie called Raising Cain. And that's my pick. I feel like the sort of the critical reevaluation, the sort of reclamation of a lot of, you know, of his sort of less regarded, financially disappointing, et cetera, has worked its way through a lot of his filmography, but I feel like Raising Cain is still pretty underrated and underseen. But it is very good, especially if you get the Shout Factory, Scream Factory Blu-ray that came out a few years ago that had a reassembled director's cut. Megan is nodding profusely. They tested it in a version that was sort of non-linear, sort of discombobulated. It tested poorly, so Universal made him sort of recut it into a more traditional format, and that version is good. That's how I first saw it in the theater, etc., etc. But like a super fan got the movie back together and some of the missing elements and reassembled it into that preview cut. And it really actually is a better version. It works better. It plays better. It does sort of more unexpected stuff. Even whichever version you're seeing, this is one of the great deranged John Lithgow performances. A wonderful Lolita Davidovich is a terrific De Palma heroine. It is weird and fun and funny. And I still remember that, like, the tagline, the theatrical tagline, I'm going to screw it up, but it was like deranged, decrepit De Palma or something like that. It was kind of a perfect tagline. So I recommend pairing this one up with Raising Kane. What about you, Mike?
Okay. We're going to do something dumb. You ready? We're going to ask what ChatGPT thinks we should double with this.
No.
Yeah, no, We're doing it on purpose. Because
are we?
Okay. Yeah, we are. That recommends Blowout, Rear Window, Basic Instinct, Mulholland Drive, Peeping Tom, and Dressed to Kill. That is why you don't ask ChatGPT for recommendations, because they're fucking dumb. Those are all great movies. This is not a comment on the movies, but it's like, you know, you remember when we did Godfather 2 and I was like, you should watch Godfather 1 if you haven't seen it? That's the level that ChatGPT thinks on.
Sure.
All right. And I just knew this was going to be the right movie to make that point and make that dig. All right. Anyway, I'm going to say the movie was mentioned already. I'm going to say Driller Killer, because a lot of times his movies, like, to me, Scarface and Carlito's Way are maybe his best movies, because you have to get to a character that fucking ridiculous for his over-stylized fucking nonsense to really play. Because, like, when you put the normal guy, the guy who is sort of playing him or us or whoever in the middle of all these crazy characters, it's an interesting thing, but it's, to me, it always, like, it's part of what leaves the tension in the movie, but it also sort of keeps the movie from really fucking exploding in the way that, like, I mean, I want Say Hello to My Little Friend. I want all the guys coming into the fucking building and the guns going off, because I know he can do that.
Yeah.
You know, like, not everybody can do that.
Sure.
And especially not the way he does it. I mean, the slow-mo piles of coke exploding with the music, and, like, I want him to do that.
Uh-huh.
And I feel like a lot of times his movies, you know, get sort of put in, like, a bit of a genre basket, you know, in a way of, like, sort of, this is, you know, a sex creep. I mean, I called it a peeper movie, but peeping doesn't go well in this film. It doesn't go well at all.
I don't mean to correct you, but I think we decided it's Sex Spencer. That's
right.
That's what we're
calling.
There
you go. It's Sex Spencer. That's right. That's right.
There you go.
So I'm saying go watch Driller Killer, because Driller Killer is a fun movie and you'll enjoy it. And you will also see the fucking difference between a genre film of this era and Body Double. You know what I mean? You'll really like if you've watched some of these movies that he's referencing, you know, some of these sort of, especially the not Hitchcock movies that he's referencing, you don't have to get a degree to be able to see the difference between what he's doing and what they're doing. So dig Driller Killer. It's fun. It's also not a Brian De Palma movie.
There you go.
In the age of battery-powered drills, everything. You're going to get the sex fence. This is the sex fence with the battery. This is not the same.
It's not the same. God, that ship with the cord is so fucking... God, he's good. Megan,
if you tried to choke somebody out with a USB charger cable, it would break. You wouldn't even be able to get it done. I had never thought of this before.
Megan, El Dorado Drive is out now. Where can people follow you on social media?
I'm not so much on Twitter anymore, but I'm on Blue Sky and Instagram and through my website, MeganEbbott.com. I'm easy to find.
There we go. I'm Jason Dash Bailey on Blue Sky and Letterboxd. Mike, where can people find you?
I am Fifth Column Films on whatever. I probably haven't looked at today.
There we go. And of course, if you like the show and you think other people might like it too, please do us the service of leaving a rating and or a review, 5-star and positive on your podcatcher of choice. Also, if you'd like to join our mailing list, we'll send you weekly show notes. You'll know how to watch the movie online. We'll send you links to things we reference. You can do all that at buttondown.email/filmfanatic. Quick reminder that my book, Gandolfini, Jim, Tony, and the Life of a Legend, is out now wherever hardbacks, ebooks, and audiobooks are sold. And if you're one of those peculiar folk, if you're someone who likes to watch, let's just keep it in the tone of the episode, the theme that we're discussing. If you like to watch, you can find us on YouTube recording this show on our channel, Guide for the Film Fanatic.
Our humblest thanks to our guiding light, Mr. Danny Perry, author of Guide for the Film Fanatic. And shout out to executive producer Blake Howard, who does not do animal acts, does not do S&M or any variations of that particular bent, and no water sports either.
Thank you again, Megan.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening. On the next Guide for the Film Fanatic, join us and our pal Matt Zoller Seitz as we discuss Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. See you then.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.